It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Saturday, December 3rd, 2022. I'm Jared Halpern. Congress steps in to prevent an economic train wreck caused by a rail labor dispute.
Our nation's rail system is literally the backbone of our supply chain, as you all well know, and so much of what we rely on is delivered on our rail.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Everything costs more these days, and that goes for heating our homes this winter, as the cost of energy continues to climb, with much of it coming down to supply and demand.
You know, if we get a colder than normal winter, you know, your natural gas bill could be 50% or more than it was a year ago.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. For much of his political career, President Biden was known as Amtrak Joe, a nod to his daily train commute as a senator. He frequently reminds people of his love of the railroads, but this week, train travel threatened to derail an economic recovery his administration is trying to keep on the tracks.
Our nation's rail system is literally the backbone of our supply chain, as you all well know, and so much of what we rely on is delivered on our rail, from clean water to food and gas and every other good. Rail shutdown would have devastated our economy. Without freight rail, many of the U.S. industries would literally shut down.
And so that's why this week President Biden pleaded with Congress to take unique action and stop a potential strike by rail workers who had rejected a labor agreement negotiated by the White House. Relying on a law that dates back to the 1920s, bipartisan majorities in the House and Senate approved a resolution imposing that agreement that a few months back was tentatively agreed to by 12 labor union representatives, but later rejected by the memberships of 4 unions. The dispute and congressional intervention put the president at odds with another one of his reputations as a pro-union Democrat. Signing the legislation this week, President Biden explained,
"In the event of a shutdown, my economic advisors report that as many as 765,000 Americans, many of them union members themselves, would have been put out of work."
So the agreement was enforced by law without an additional 7 paid sick days that union members had been demanding during labor talks. The potential rail strike concerns dominated the week on Pennsylvania Avenue that also saw a high-profile visitor, the President of France. I covered both stories from the White House this week, along with my colleague, Fox News congressional correspondent Chad Pergram, who reported from Capitol Hill.
Well, you know, back in the 1920s and 1930s, Congress determined that the rail industry was so important to the American economy that they said, we have to take control of this. There were some other talks at the time of nationalizing, federalizing the rail industry, and they didn't want to go quite that far. So they said, if there's to be a strike, we're going to pass a bill, pass a law that says we will intervene and be able to stop a railroad strike. And they enrolled the airlines into that eventually. The only time this happened before was in 1992, where Congress injected itself when there was a short strike back then. Again, there are economic consequences. And lawmakers, particularly those who are pro-labor Democrats, said, we just don't want to get involved trumping the other side. You know, the labor unions, they're trying to come to a deal. We don't want to, you know, bigfoot what they're trying to do. So that was very concerning. Meantime, you have these, you know, small government Republicans who, libertarians, you know, who say, you know, why should the government be in charge? It's up to them. But here was the issue. You had Marty Walsh, the Secretary of Labor, Pete Buttigieg, the transportation secretary, they came to Capitol Hill and they said, if you don't intervene, there is going to be a Christmas time calamity here. You're not going to be having, you know, shipments of gifts for the holidays, products, agriculture goods, fertilizer, chlorine for water supplies. I mean, the stuff that actually makes our water safe to drink that, you know, cities and towns rely on all over the country. And a lot of that was going to stop over the weekend. So this is why Congress had to act right away. The deadline for the strike was actually at the end of this coming week. But they were going to stop some of these shipments for stuff that you can't leave sitting in rail cars and railroads, you know, around for several days. They said, OK, we're going to cut that off right now. So that's why a lot of members, you know, they really said, OK, we got to take one for the team. If you listen to Republicans, they kind of knew that they had to take those votes, but they kind of turned this around on their favorite whipping boy, President Biden, saying, you told us back in September that you had this worked out. If you had this worked out in September, this is on you, Mr. President. You know, so, you're supposed to be the most pro-labor president of all time. And so, you know, that was the political ploy by Republicans. We're saying, OK, we'll vote for it, but we're going to blame this on Mr. Biden.
I want to talk about sort of the logistics of how this works and how Congress sort of is able to implement these labor agreements. But I want to get back to something you said, where you said there were Democrats, progressive Democrats, pro-union Democrats who were concerned about, you know, sort of undercutting this negotiation position for these four rail unions. But you also had statements from Republicans like Marco Rubio, Josh Hawley, who said, you know, I don't know if we should be forcing workers to do something they don't want to do. The workers rejected this sort of like pro-worker strain. It's kind of new in the Republican Party, this sort of this populism that's taken hold over both parties. No,
it was. And there were kind of three camps on the Republican side, and some of it was based on geography. You had Republicans who said, OK, we can't let the economy melt down, so we got to do something. OK, then you had mostly the Southern Republicans. You mentioned Rubio, Tom Cotton from Arkansas, some others who said maybe we, you know, these guys deserve something, you know, with the, you know, with the 7 days.
They wanted 7 days of paid sick leave.
Yes. Paid sick leave. And they thought if the unions aren't willing to accept this, why should we intervene? And then you had this other faction of Republicans and Dan Sullivan, the Republican from Alaska, and he was the most vocal, had an amendment that they voted on, only got 26 votes for this. But it would have gotten Congress out of this and implemented another 2 month long cooling off period where the bargainers from both sides, the unions and the rail companies, could go back to the table and say, OK, what can we work out? Can we work something out here to avoid a strike? That just didn't pass. And that was never taken up by the House at all. That was something that the House didn't consider at all.
I mean, it was just a fascinating sort of, you know, politics sometimes makes for strange bedfellows. And I was just reminded that this was one of those weeks where, you know, you have these issues that the left and right sometimes overlap a little bit, coming from sort of different angles, but the positions end up overlapping. So Congress basically, I want to understand sort of the authority here that Congress used, that the president asked Congress to use. So there was this labor dispute over the summer. They negotiate, 12 unions involved with the major railroad companies. Congress basically ordered a presidential commission to kind of mediate this, right? And then they do. So the law then says after that process, Congress can sort of force that mediated settlement.
Right. And that goes back to the rail law from the 1920s and 30s, because that was part of the agreement so that they would not federalize the railroads, that they would actually work something out, that they had this very unique labor negotiating process and mediation board and so on that dates back to the 20s and 30s. There's really not a lot of industries that are treated this way
in
the United States.
That's so interesting. Yeah, you don't see,
and it all goes back to that 1920 passed the law in 1926. They updated it in the 1930s.
And so the president signs this on Friday, and this settles it now. I mean, there won't be a rail strike. This collective bargaining agreement's now in place for a couple of years.
Right. I had one host on Fox Business, David Asman, the other day, said, well, Chad, they could still strike and break the law, couldn't they? And I said, yes. I mean, they could do anything. What's that Judas Priest song, breaking the law, if you know the song? But they could do that. I took note with Bernie Sanders' statement, the independent senator from Vermont. Mm-hmm. And he said after the vote, and he was the biggest advocate in the building for the 7 days of paid medical leave. And he said, we will be back This struggle continues. The fight is not over. And now that might be just not to this industry, but other industries as well. And I wouldn't be surprised if somebody tries to put something in to this big omnibus spending bill that they're trying to pass later this year. And that means in the next 3 weeks here, to avoid a government shutdown, fund the government through next fall of 2023. Because this issue is hot right now. You know, you strike in Congress when the iron is hot, and the iron on that issue is hot right now.
Let's talk a little bit about the other big story here that sort of hit both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. That was the state visit by the French president, Emmanuel Macron. He had a state dinner here at the White House. A lot of meetings, conversations with President Biden, but he also traveled to Capitol Hill and met with key lawmakers. I assume the issue was continued U.S. support financially for Ukraine.
There's two things going on there. Yes, the first one is absolutely, you know, how the United States can help Ukraine in its fight against Russia. The Europeans are very concerned about this bleeding over, because if Ukraine were to ever get overrun by Russia, some parts of Eastern Europe and maybe other parts might be next. So that's something that's very, you know, a big concern. Obviously, NATO allies are concerned about this. The other part is kind of ancillary and maybe more immediate, is that you have the issue of, of how do they heat energy issues in Europe, stuff coming from Russia, stuff coming from Ukraine. We've talked about the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, et cetera. And so if you have these heating prices skyrocketing in the United Kingdom and elsewhere in Europe, France is going to have a problem there. The better you can make things and settle the war in Ukraine, and the better you can figure out some sort of an energy situation there, that's going to be better for the rest of Western Europe. And they need United States help in this. Emmanuel Macron, he comes to Washington at a time of political turmoil in the world, political turmoil in the United States, although it might be a little calmer than now. I was struck by the fact at the state dinner with the president that they served three types of cheeses. And I'm reminded by this quote by Charles de Gaulle when he was the French leader. And you think about how diverse and different France is. And he said, how do you expect me to govern a country that has 246 different types of cheeses? And so you could probably transfer that to the United States. We don't have 246 different types of cheeses, but we got 246 different types of problems here.
How much of this, too, the Macron message to Congress was sort of underlying this growing uncertainty about Ukraine aid with a Republican-led House? You certainly have a faction of the Republican wing of Congress that is, saying it's time to end this. You've had Kevin McCarthy say, maybe not end it, but we need to have more oversight of it. It can't be a blank check. Are there concerns?
He's been very careful about that language,
yeah.
And that's almost verbatim what he has said, which is a wink and a nod saying we're not going to spend any more than we have to. We're going to take
so
a look at the
concern?
Books.
Is there a concern for Macron,
yes,
from the EU that the U.S. commitment may not be as robust as it has been?
Europe is very worried about this, and the Ukrainians are too, because there are definite factions in the Republican Party now who don't want to fund things at all. And this is part of the tightrope that Kevin McCarthy must walk in the coming weeks to become
segment.
Speaker.
Yeah.
We'll be talking about that in the weeks ahead,
to be sure.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. But the idea that he has to say these things about Ukraine and funding and money, because if he says something that is wrong to different constituencies in the Republican Party, they're going to undercut him, because they're, this is almost unheard of. We never would have thought about this just a few years ago, that, if you had Russia invade somewhere, that we would not try to help the other side. I mean, you have people like Marjorie Taylor Greene saying, well, what is Ukraine, the 51st state? This is how serious this problem is in the Republican Party. And that's why, I talked about a big bill to fund the government. That's why people want to make sure that money is in that bill now. I was struck that during the weekly colloquy between Steve Scalise, the minority whip for now, and Steny Hoyer, the majority leader for now, they talk on the House floor. It's a public colloquy where they go back and forth about the upcoming week's schedule. And you can listen to this on the House floor. And Scalise was asking about if the annual defense bill was ready for consideration. And Hoyer said, I wish it was ready to at least be filed today. It's not. We're working soon. There's some speculation the aid for Ukraine, or maybe some indirect aid for Ukraine, could be in that bill. Or that's another way to do that. But, you know, this is all about railroads this week, Jared. All trains are leaving the congressional station here at the end of the month, whether it be dealing with the rail strike or passing money for Ukraine or keeping the government open or, you know, attending to the, you know, military and the defense bill. I mean, you know, it's kind of like they used to say, you know, be aware that the light at the end of the tunnel, which we think we're going to get at the end of this year, but that light at the end of the tunnel may, in fact, be an oncoming train.
Let me finish with this to sort of bring these two stories together, because at the state dinner honoring Emmanuel Macron, both Kevin McCarthy and Steve Scalise were invited guests. Do we read anything into that? Is this a thawing of the tensions as a Republican majority now begins to plot its way forward here in the new Congress in working with President Biden in this administration?
Well, you know, I think it's important that they were invited. You know, there's again, there's probably certain constituencies in the Republican Party would say, well, why are you going around, you know, President Biden, state dinners? That's not our thing. Who knows what those private conversations may have been? You know, it would be a bigger problem if they didn't invite them. So that's one way to do this. You know, there's really not a lot of a relationship between the president and McCarthy and others. I mean, he talked about, McCarthy did, that, you know, some years ago, you know, various disputes that they had, debt ceiling, et cetera. But he had breakfast with President Biden, talked to him several times a day, been to his house, that sort of thing here. But again, you had other Republicans, an incoming Florida Representative Corey Mills. He said on Fox earlier this week, he said that just the state dinner, he said it's another with the French president. He says it's another example of Joe Biden's America Last agenda. And this comes back to your point earlier. He's more worried about trying to help the Europeans' energy crisis or the European Union's economy or the Ukrainian borders than he is to actually help secure America's borders and build up our own economy here at home. So here you have an incoming, very conservative freshman elect who's beating up the president. Just the fact that he's meeting with Macron, because that gives the imprimatur that you're more worried about France than you are worried about Florida. So, you know, that's,
I mean, I think state
that's the problem.
State dinners always provide these like uniquely Washington moments. We saw one of the photographs from this week from the state dinner of Steve Scalise talking with the press corps as he's walking into the White House wearing his tuxedo, and who walks behind him and sort of nods and puts his hands up in the air as Steve Scalise is talking, retired Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. So,
right. Exactly.
You know,
Jared, I have a question for you. Where were you seated at the dinner?
Yeah, you know what I did the night of the dinner, because my invitation was obviously lost in the mail, because I know would have been invited, is
yes, of course.
I was at Nats Park with my son and wife. They have a little skating rink set up there, holiday light maze, and I braved the cold weather at Nats Park instead of the tent that they had set up for the state dinner.
You know, Jared, that there's a famous story at a White House dinner, you know, 50, 60 years ago, and there was a mayor who was invited to a state dinner and didn't want to be seen with the president, and thought that that was all too frou-frou and it was bad optics for him to go to the dinner, you know, even though he had been invited. And so he wanted to make sure that he wasn't, and he used this as political opportunity. You know, all, you know, politics is local. So he kind of turned this around. On one hand, it'd be a great opportunity to come to Washington and rub elbows with the rich and powerful in Washington, D.C. But he kind of turned around the other way. And he said, I respectfully decline the invitation because it is my wife's bowling night. And so the mayor did not attend the state dinner in Washington, D.C.
So I got priorities. Well, Chad, I'm sorry that neither one of us were able to chat at that state dinner, but we'll continue.
It was my wife's bowling night, Jared.
That's right. Yeah, we all had other stuff to do. It's fine. We're busy people, and that's
skating with your family. I had bowling. Yeah,
I'm
absolutely
sure the White House understood. Listen, we'll talk next week, I think, as we see if we can come up with 218 for Kevin McCarthy.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jared.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, the Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Inflation is still high, though not quite as high as it was this summer, and yet, even so, It's about to play a big role in keeping us warm through the winter. The Energy Department says it's going to cost us a lot more to heat our homes through these cold months, 28% more to heat homes using natural gas, 10% more using electricity, about 27% more using home heating oil.
We have a really dark winter to look forward to, unfortunately.
Power the Future Executive Director Daniel Turner told Fox Business recently this is partly due to government involvement in the energy sector in his mind, but it's also simply a supply and demand issue.
Our propane levels are low, our natural gas levels are low, our coal levels are low, and coal is at a four-time high. So these are the issues. Look, energy policy isn't always sexy. I get it, right? I mean, most people fall asleep when we talk energy. But in the consequence, it powers and fuels and grows and transports and manufactures everything in society.
The Biden administration announced $4.5 billion will go to help Americans pay utility bills this winter through the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program. It's an increase in funding, but not as much as the amount given in assistance during COVID. And while some of this year's additional money is coming from the infrastructure bill, other cash was approved as emergency funding by Congress. Still, some people in some regions are hoping the government can do more by removing a barrier. A group of governors in New England had asked for a waiver to the Jones Act so they can get more energy shipped to them at a lower cost and faster. There is a bright spot in all of this. Gas prices have come down, but it's not clear if they will stay down. And either way, they're still up overall, as are all the ways we heat our homes.
I mean, people are bringing out parkas they wouldn't have worn since the 1980s because they know that they'd rather have their thermostat a little bit lower than shell out a bunch of cash.
Phil Flynn is a senior market analyst at Price Futures Group and a Fox Business contributor.
But, you know, right now, if you look across the board, whether you're heating your home with natural gas or heating oil or propane or electricity, you know, pretty much across the board, your prices are going to be higher. How much higher? You know, if we get a colder than normal winter, you know, your natural gas bill could be 50% or more than it was a year ago. Heating oil could be 40% higher, electricity 20% higher, and propane could be 36% higher. So nobody's getting a free ride on this.
Let's briefly, and I don't know if we have done the math. I was reading that the math sort of varies, but like, for example, in New England, it could be as much as $2,300 extra for the winter.
Correct.
To heat your home. For others, it might be around $400 or $500 extra this winter. Have we done the amount more that we're paying? I mean, I know you gave percentages, but in terms of amounts, is
I think it comes down to Mother Nature. How cold is it going to be, right? And how many, they call it heating degree days. You know, when it's really cold, when you really have to get that thermostat working and burning a lot of energy, that's where the percentage comes. You mentioned New England, and that's key because most of New England still uses, at least a lot of the homes still use home heating oil. And home heating oil supplies are tight, mainly because of a lack of refining capacity in the United States because we've lost some refineries and the inability to import diesel fuel from places like Russia because of the Russian oil ban. So now we're going into this winter with some of the tightest supplies of like heating oil that we probably have seen in a generation. Okay.
And
there's no room for error.
Is heating oil connected to diesel?
It is. It really is. You know, a lot of people are saying, what's the difference between diesel and heating oil? And the answer is not a lot, right? You know, if you look at the category called distillate fuels, it includes things like heating oil, diesel, and other products that we use every day. And a lot of factories use diesel fuel not only in the trucks to move goods, but to run their factories. And the crazy thing is that historically, diesel fuel has been a relatively cheap fuel. But now, anybody who looks at the difference between the cost of diesel fuel and gasoline, for example, are seeing those prices so much higher than gasoline, mainly because of the green energy movement and the movement to shut down refineries and make diesel cheaper. And that really has had a big impact across the economy because just about every business on the planet Earth is impacted by the cost of diesel.
Phil, let's get into more about why the costs are going up in this manner. Because, for example, like with natural gas, I was reading, you know, we're sending now a lot of LNG to Europe, obviously, because of what's going on with Russia and Ukraine. Right. So the existing supply, right, has a heavier demand. Is that why we're dealing with higher price? I mean, I know you just referenced the green energy movement, but everything, you know, every time you open, you know, any article, it's always like Russia is the reason we're all paying more for energy.
Right. And it's either Russia or Russia. You're right. And that has had an impact, right? You know, because it has been Russia. But the reality is that the main reason why our natural gas prices are higher than they have been isn't just Russia. It's because of the anti-pipeline movement in this country. You have to realize that the United States is the world's biggest producer of natural gas. In fact, we're producing a record amount of natural gas right now. And the crazy thing about it is that if we were allowed to build pipelines all over the country, we could get that natural gas to New England. We could replace all heating oil. We could replace electricity. We could send it to New York City. But we have this, you know, movement against fossil fuels that refuses to allow the industry to build out these pipelines. So a lot of this natural gas is going to waste, and it's a major component that which could have kept prices low. You know, as far as exporting it to other countries, I'm all for that. But at the same time, let's build up the infrastructure so our people here at home can take advantage of lower prices as well.
And Phil, briefly, natural gas, is that looked at on the market the same way that oil is? I know oil, for example, you put it out onto the market, right? It's a global commodity. So even if you produce a lot of it, it all ends up sort of in the same pot. Is that the same for natural gas? Or if we produce so much more of it, we could theoretically keep more of it?
Yeah, it's slightly different because, you know, years ago, natural gas prices were basically local. And the reason why was because after you produce natural gas, really the only way to move it efficiently was through pipelines, right? And so, you know, unlike oil where you can put it on a tanker and send it overseas, years ago it was very difficult to do that with natural gas, you know, and you couldn't build a pipeline under the ocean. Obviously, technology has come to the point where we have liquefied natural gas, right? So now we can freeze this stuff, put it on tankers and move it. The problem is to be able to do that in the type of quantities that we need, it's going to take years of investment to build terminals and ships that can move this on the same scale that you can move oil. So more and more, you're right, it's becoming more like oil. It's becoming more influenced by what's happening in Europe, and it definitely has an impact. But it still is kind of a local story as well. And that's a big story. And that's another reason. Listen, the U.S. has been blessed with an abundance of natural gas. Our prices are cheaper pretty much than any place, you know, any industrialized place in the world. And other countries are jealous of us, you know, and, you know, they, you know, there's some countries, I'm sure China's looking at us and saying, what the heck are they doing? They're sitting on this natural gas. It's cleaner burning. Why aren't they building pipelines all over the country? I can tell you if this gas was in China, China would definitely be taking advantage of it. And here at home, we're not.
There was this Politico article that got a bit of attention. I'm assuming you read it, but in case you didn't, it said that European leaders are now mad at us, and they're accusing us of profiting the most off of the war in Ukraine because, you know, they accuse us of selling all this natural gas and additional weapons. But just on the gas front, I was a little confused by that, because if our energy companies are profiting because of the war, U.S. consumers and residents certainly are not. I mean, we're talking about how we're all going to be paying higher prices. And if they need the gas and we have it, what is the alternative then? Paying Russia for the gas? I mean, that's why we're backfilling them, right? We're giving them...
Right, exactly.
Selling them the gas that they would have been paying Russia for. So what did you make of what the accusations were in this piece?
I think they're trumped up. They're angry, and they're trying to blame somebody else for their own problems, right?
I mean, and, should we lower prices for the sake of Europe in wartime?
No, we shouldn't. And this is the problem. I mean, the reason why they have to come to us here in the United States and pay these high prices is because they refuse to develop their own natural gas resources at home, right? They're the country that shut down their nuclear power plants. They shut down they reduced their dependence on natural gas, and they said that they could depend on Russia for supply. So they made some serious policy errors over the last 10 or 20 years that left them short supply. Now, prices are going through the roof, and I can tell you this, whatever they're paying for a U.S. tanker of LNG, it's a lot cheaper than any other tanker almost any place in the world, because we have the cheapest natural gas on the planet right now. And so to make this accusation sounds so crazy that it sounds like it could have come from the Biden administration, right? Okay. Wait a second. Ooh, wait a second. Didn't the Biden administration accuse the U.S. energy industry of war profiteering and price gouging? So it looks like they're taking a page out of President Biden's playbook. But let's step back and look a little bit. You know, there is no doubt that the United States, from an energy standpoint, has a distinct advantage over Europe, right? Because of the shale gas revolution. You know, the problem is the Biden administration keeps wanting to bite the hand that feeds it, because the only reason we're able to do that is because of the technological breakthroughs by the U.S. energy industry. So again, you know, when we start accusing the industry of war profiteering, we should be thanking them, you know, for supplies. As far as prices being up globally, you know, and people here at home, the problem isn't the energy companies making money or the government making money. It's bad energy policy, short-sighted thinking, and an anti-fossil fuel, an agenda that really has restricted supplies in the U.S. You know, we shouldn't be seeing record high prices in the U.S. We should be seeing consistently low prices in the U.S., but the government and the regulatory burden on the energy industry just continues to restrict supplies. We could supply this country with cheap natural gas for more than 100 years, if not longer. But we refuse to do that because we keep telling people we want to get off fossil fuels and power the economy by wind and solar.
I should also note this Politico Europe article didn't have anybody on the record. They were all anonymous people complaining about the U.S. So, but it does get to a larger point, right, that it is Europe that is even more intensely dealing with higher energy costs. There was even talk briefly about asking each country to limit their energy usage. Did that end up going anywhere?
Well, I think they're going to be forced to by higher prices. So I think you are going to see a reduction in demand. The biggest thing they're trying to get through now is a price cap on Russian oil, which is laughable. You know, I mean, I tell everybody one of the first things I learned in commodity economics was you show me a price cap and I'll show you a shortage, right? I mean, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but if you cap the price of trying to cap the price of a commodity is like trying to cage a wild animal. It might work for a while, but if he ever gets out of the cage, you better watch out. You know, there's going to be a lot of carnage.
And Phil, to that point, though, the irony is that my understanding is that even if you want a price cap, you still want the Russian oil in the market, because without it, you reduce supply further, and that shoots costs up more. So there's some there's this weird balancing act, right? That's happening because you still want the Russian oil out there.
Yeah, like I want to buy your baseball card of Babe Ruth. You've got one, right? But I'm only going to pay. I'm going to cap my price at $500. I want that card. You're going to sell it to me, whether you like it or not. You're crazy, Phil. I'm not going to sell it to you, right? Or maybe you will. I don't know. You're nuts, but most people wouldn't. But
my father wouldn't let me.
Let's assume, you know, and that's what Russia is saying right now. It's like, go ahead. If you know, listen, don't do this. You know, first of all, price caps don't work anyway. Over time, they always turn out to be a disaster. But even if they put it on for a short period of time, you know, Russia's come out and said, listen, we want to supply you with oil, but the minute you cap the price, we will refuse to sell you any oil. So as soon as the price cap goes in, Russia cuts off supply. And, you know, and prices go up. And you know, if anybody thinks Putin won't do that, obviously they haven't been paying attention to what's been going on in Ukraine.
Okay, one more for you, Phil. With all of this talk, it does seem like there might be a bright spot. I want your thoughts on why we might be seeing this bright spot, because I was filling up my car the other day.
Right.
It was not nearly as high as it had been. I looked at the fancy gas, you know, the 93 instead of the 87, and it was even under $4. And I just want your thoughts on how that happened, because I know the president says, well, we released from the strategic reserve and that helped. But then other folks are saying, well, actually, reduced demand in China is playing a role. What is happening with gas prices?
How many tweets in the last 24 to 48 hours have you seen by the Biden administration taking a victory lap for the drop in gasoline prices, right? Mm-hmm. You know, hey, they're back before they were in the war of Ukraine. Don't look at the fact that they're still like a dollar higher than they were when you took office. I mean, listen, the bottom line is, you're right, demand has dropped off a little bit. The China has shut down. When China reopens, demand's going to come back. Prices are going to go back up. Part of it is seasonal. You know, we've switched to wintertime blends of gasoline. It becomes cheaper. But you know who the real unsung hero is in the break in gasoline prices? I'll tell you. It's the U.S. energy and mainly the refining industry. And a few months ago, when we looked at supplies being at the lowest level they've been in 70 years, there was real concern that we wouldn't have enough products to keep our economy going, right? Or keep people warm at night. You know, we saw the supplies of diesel fuel at the lowest level we've ever seen in winter. And, you know, if you were an odds maker watching a football game, you would think that the chances of us getting up to snuff, you know, by game time, you know, that, you know, we would be a four touchdown underdog. But what happened? U.S. refiners have done an amazing thing. With reduced refining capacity, they have squeezed more blood out of a turnip, out of those old refineries, producing more oil and gas as a percentage of the capacity that's available, unlike anything we've seen. You know, taking a huge deficit, you know, and bringing us back to almost normal levels. Now, we're still not out of the woods yet. We still have a long way to go. But what they've done is a patriotic, in my opinion, and they rose to the occasion to alleviate, which could have been a very dangerous shortage. So if anybody needs to take a victory lap, I say it's the U.S. refining industry, because I've never seen anything like it. And they have exceeded not only my expectations, but expectations from a historical viewpoint, unlike anything we've seen before.
Wow. Interesting. I didn't know that. Phil Flynn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the Fox News Rundown from Washington, we take a look at the Senate runoff election in Georgia. Republican Herschel Walker faces Democratic incumbent Raphael Warnock. Then, Tennessee Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn discusses the Open App Markets Bill, which she says is meant to reduce Apple and Google's control over their app stores. Until then, I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Thanks for listening to the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Please rate and review this podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.